Okay, how am I going to open this?
It's funny, isn't it? You're exactly like me. I'm delighted. I'm sorry, but I'm delighted to see that. It's not just me. It's the opening is so crucial.
I'm Georgie Crawford. This is the Good Glow Podcast. I believe we all have a story. And by telling these stories, we can inspire and empower each other on our self-care journey. This season, I've teamed up with ReproMed, Ireland's leading fertility clinics. Having been through IVF myself, I understand how daunting a fertility journey can be. I'm proud to partner with ReproMed, whose world-class team offer the expertise, empathy, and compassionate care needed to help and support you. With clinics in Galway, Dublin, Cork, Drogheda, and Kilkenny, they are never too far away and will do everything possible to help you grow your family. Visit ReproMed.ie for more. And now their sister clinic, ReproScan.ie, is available for early pregnancy and gender scanning. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Good Glow Podcast. Whatever you may be doing today, listening out for a walk or making the dinner on the way to work, thank you so much for choosing the Good Glow to keep you company. My God, do I have a podcast for you today with my friend Brian Penny, who joined us on stage at the Good Glow Live back in November. And I got so many messages from people saying, we want more of Brian. So that day has finally come. For 15 years, Brian hid a chronic heroin addiction. Things got really bad for him. He had been able to hold down a job. But in October 2013, he hit rock bottom. Today, he speaks to us about his life before and his life after. He also does a little bit of coaching on this podcast, which I love. He talks about, you know, flying at 15,000 feet, how we can keep investing in ourselves to keep ourselves well and to put out the best version of ourselves. And I think for anybody who may be experiencing anxiety or self-doubt, Brian is the perfect person to remind us that change is possible. He's one of the most inspiring people that I have ever met, and I'm so proud to call him a friend. I know you're going to be hanging on his every word. His energy is electric. He is a gift to us all, and I can't wait to get into it. Before we do, I just want to remind you that we are heading back to the National Concert Hall on May 30th. Tickets are on sale now over on nch.ie. We have the Dublin Gospel Choir. We're going to have inspiring talks, inspiring guests. We're going to lift the room. I want people punching the air as they make their way out of the concert hall that night, feeling like they can take on the world. That's our aim. And that's what we hope to do on May 30th. So nch.ie for tickets. Now, let's get into Brian. Brian, we were just talking before we came on air about divine timing. And I really believe that the time is right for us to finally have this conversation on the Good Glow. So welcome. Thank you so much for taking the time out today. And just to let you know, I'm so grateful for your time today.
Thanks for having me, George. We've had so many little mini conversations where we jumped into different things. I had you on my own radio show at one stage, and I'm just dying to really get into the weeds on a couple of topics that we've touched on but haven't really gotten deep on today. So thanks for having me.
Oh, I've been so excited. And, you know, I went for a walk earlier. I listened to a podcast you did about Pat Dively, which was brilliant. And I was trying to, I always think about my first question. So what is my first question going to be? So as I listened to you tell your story, and I'm so excited to hear your story today, I wanted to start by asking you, how different are your days now to what they used to be? So a typical day for you now and a typical day before.
Wow. But when I was in the depths of addiction, basically. Yeah. Well, the first words that came to mind, it wasn't even a word. It was a feeling that came to mind there, Georgie. And it was the word dread, and the feeling. I could actually feel it in my stomach, and I could feel it in my chest. And then I just think of Groundhog Day. And interestingly enough, my life today is a little bit like Groundhog Day. It's just a nicer Groundhog Day. But when I think back of a day in the life of Brian, let's say 2010, when I was really in the depths of addiction, it was literally, I still worked at the time, so I was in the depths of heroin addiction, still trying to scrape and to hold on to my job. And I used to go into work crippled with anxiety, which drove my whole addiction. I didn't have an addiction problem. I had an anxiety problem that was getting worse because of my addiction. And it was like a fire, just an electrical fire just rippling through my body. And the drugs weren't working anymore. So I'd go into work, take some drugs to take off the edge. I'd get off at about 5 o'clock. I then do a bag of heroin. I drink a bottle of vodka. I take lots of benzodiazepines, just a multitude of different drugs to numb the pain. But none of them are really working anymore. So they put me into this stupor, this painful stupor. I'd go home, comatose myself for a few hours, usually wake up about 2 a.m, generally not have any drugs left, wouldn't be able to sleep. Try to get asleep till about 4 or 5 a.m, might get an hour, wake up at 7, late for work and have to do it all over again. It was ultimate dread, monotonous, just a painful, painful experience. It really was. It's actually, I haven't thought about it in a long time. And it's interesting that your question is really around the comparison. And when I think of my life, like I named my book Bonus Time because I believe I was given a second chance at life. And I think that comparison really just sets it up for me, because today I wake up full of energy. I wake up with a smile on my face. I get into action straight away. I do things and surround myself with people that are going to support me, lift me energy. And just really, I just have a beautiful life today with really light, lovely feelings. And the comparison of those 2 days is really, really powerful when I think about it.
Wow. And we even brought you out onto the stage at the Good Glow Live in November. And we had spoken before that conversation just about, you know, what we were going to talk about and things like that. And I'll never forget just listening to you on the stage and almost just feeling like we were the only two people in the room. And I think people in the audience felt that. So afterwards, I'll never forget, I got my sister-in-law came up to me afterwards and just said, "Who was that? Like, oh my God." And she went home with her husband and they Googled you, right? So like 11 o'clock at night, came home from the show, wanted more, wanted the full story, which we obviously didn't have time for at the Good Glow Live. And you know, I know that you know, because I kept telling you, but that people were hanging on your every word of your story. You've come so far and it's so incredibly inspiring. And you say that your heroin addiction stemmed from anxiety. And did it take you a while to figure that out or make that connection?
Yeah, I never knew that, Georgie. So I had a lot of trauma in my life. I had a lot of trauma as an infant, like physical trauma. I had an operation, an operation without a general anaesthetic as an infant. It was a crazy medical practice at the time. So I had a lot of bodily trauma. And I sort of, like, I lived my life. I had a lot of trauma then as a child as well, like around alcohol and stuff like that as well. But I remember just living my life as a kid, just bodily sensations. Like I was afraid of my heartbeat. I was afraid of my pulse. I was afraid of my breath. These were things that I was actually fearful of. So my anxiety was really driven around bodily sensations. And then that sort of fear came into a fear of death. I was afraid of my parents are going to die. And I was afraid of my family were going to die. And I was just always worrying about what was going to happen. And I remember when I had a panic attack at 20 years of age. So I was dabbling in drugs for a long time at this stage, and I was taking heroin on a regular basis up until from 17 years of age to 20, but didn't believe I was a real addict. Like I seen myself as someone that was going places, done heroin a couple of times a week, but it was really closing in. It had me in its claws at this stage. And I remember at that time I had my first panic attack, and the doctor said it to me. He says, yeah, that was an anxiety attack. You have anxiety. And I didn't even know what anxiety was. It was never labeled at that time, but I was saying that wasn't anxiety. 50. I dismissed the idea that it could have been a mental problem. I thought it was a weakness and I thought it had to be physical. So I never even put those together. It was only in retrospect when I got clean that I realized that anxiety and fear and mental struggles are a signal that something is wrong, that we need to do something about it. But if we don't read those signals in the right way, we will use a maladaptive strategy to overcome them, a coping technique. And mine was drugs. I was terrified of anxiety and I used drugs. And that's all it was. But I didn't recognize that until I got clean. It was very over a lot of time, retrospectively, when I went into my studies in psychology as well. So it was a long process.
So when you took drugs then, and excuse like if this is a stupid question, but when you were using heroin, did you inject it?
So another little story I told myself, like I think we're all masters of self-deception. I was a particularly good master. I was a black belt in self-deception. So I told myself in the early days, I wasn't a real addict. And I believed that for a long, long time. Then when I admitted, right, I have a big problem here, but I'm not going to be one of those addicts that injects. But I got there in the end. Then I sold drugs to fund my addiction. But I says, yeah, but I wouldn't sell heroin. But then I got there in the end. So it was like, I always fooled myself to not believe I'll get to the next steps. But I always got there in the end. And in the end, when I wasn't getting anything off heroin, even though I had a very bad needle phobia, I still started injecting myself.
Wow. And when you said that you like went to work every day, were you able to hide it from people or do you think it was very obvious?
Yeah, it's crazy. So and not only was I not able to hide it, they used to hide me, Georgie. So I had a lovely group of friends, nearly family in my job. And I was there for so many years. Wonderful, beautiful people in that company. And my friends in the job nearly became the managers of the department where I worked. So they wanted the best for me. They didn't want to sack me and let me go, but they knew I was on methadone. They knew I was a heroin addict. Or even me, it was my boss at the time. He knew from the very early days, but there was nothing he could do about it because he was my friend. And I worked in the pharma industry and I got to the stage where pharmaceutical companies were coming in to audit us as a company. And they used to say, ring up and make a phone call and say, hide Brian in the dark room. We're coming up now. And like, when you think of that, like, it's beautiful because you were trying to protect me, but it was a form of enabling. And it's what kind of kept me in addiction for a long time. Like, I still, even in the depths of addiction, and I was struggling with that dread that I described at the start, I put on a mask, a happy-go-lucky mask. And I think it is my natural default as well to be a happy person. And that sort of shone through when people tried to help me, but it sort of kept me in the depths of addiction then as well.
Wow, Brian. And when I see you now, right, or anytime I get a voice memo from you or have an interaction with you, like I come away like punching the air, right? So I'm like, oh my God, like he is the happiest person on the planet. Were you like that when you were on drugs too?
No, there was an element of that in me. Like when I talk about the trauma I suffered as a kid, and I remember chatting to my mom about this, it was really a paradox in itself because I was so worried so much. I was always up in my head. But there was this fun-loving kid there as well that loved to play football, loved to go on adventures. And even in the depths of addiction, there was that part of me was always there. But the deeper I got into addiction, it was like a cloak, a dark cloak just wrapping around me and squeezing me tighter and tighter. I was squeezing that happiness and squeezing that energy out of me. And in the end, I got very angry. I got very bitter. I was dead on the inside. Like I really was. And I squeezed every little bit of that out of me. And there's some pictures of me, especially in the latter days of addiction, where you look at me and I look like the saddest person on the planet. I really do.
Who was fighting your corner, or did your family kind of turn a blind eye to what was happening, or were you able to hide it?
No, I wasn't able to hide it. I tried to hide it. All of my family knew I was a methadone addict. Like my poor mother for many years didn't know. Like I used to hide my methadone under the bed, and I remember me empty bottles of methadone under the bed because I was taking methadone every day on top of the other drugs, and she just thought there was hash and alcohol involved. And she was putting a curtain rail up one day and the little beads fell behind the back of the bed, and she turned up the mattress and there was like 40 empty methadone bottles with me name all over them. She was like, what the hell is going on? And that's how she found out about that. But it was crazy because my family, they didn't know how to help me. and they tried to help me, but they didn't know how to help me, but they were in me corner all of the time. Like, even within all of the bad parts of me childhood and stuff like that, I always felt loved and I knew they were there for me. And when I got clean, the support I had from my family, to say it was off the charts is an understatement. My whole family, brothers, sisters, mom and dad, drove down to Wexford every single week for the family days, where some people wouldn't even get one family member coming down. So the support I had was incredible. And that was at a stage when they could help me. They didn't even know they were helping me at the time, but just to have that support around me was just was fantastic. But they couldn't help me at the time, because there's something about addiction that is, when you are in that mode of addiction, that's your ego, that's your sense of self. Your addiction is your protective, is the thing that protects you. Like, my story, the narrative of my life was, I cannot cope with anxiety, I need heroin to survive. That was my ego, my story, myself, my beliefs. So if somebody tried to take that away from me, I would fight them with everything I had, because that's who I was. That was my identity. So, like, I remember a clinic worker saying to me at one time, if they tried to come at me and talk to me in any way, they says, I would take out my machine gun of verbal diarrhea, and they'd be exhausted after the conversation.
So you were basically numbing yourself, numbing the anxiety with drugs. And I think we can all in some way relate to numbing ourselves with things. And I think, you know, even on, it's probably the complete opposite end of the scale, but like numbing ourselves with our phones just so we don't have to be. Is that the word?
It's the same thing, Georgie. Like, the one thing I've understood from addiction is that addiction is addiction. The same processes are happening all of the time. So the great thing about being a heroin addict, it's a very obvious problem addiction, that it's like, it's highlighted. You nearly have to act on that because there's something wrong. But when it comes to the phone addictions, and smoking is a little bit the same as well, the consequences aren't as obvious. And sometimes we just let them sit there. I've noticed something with myself there only 2 weeks ago, Georgie, that I find myself wanting to check my phone at traffic lights, and I'm in the house. It's like a sniff of boredom, a sniff of sitting with myself, and I had this little urge to check my phone. And I'm starting to say to myself, right, I have to nip this in the bud now, because this is a problem. Like, I'm checking Sky Sports when I don't even want to check Sky Sports, and it's just it's crazy. Or BBC News to see what's going on. Like, 7 minutes later, check it again. Like, there's not something new. Like, there hasn't been another football match being played, and it's really bizarre. It's like this: we don't like sitting with ourselves in any way whatsoever, especially if there's emotional discomfort there. So what do? We use something to distract ourselves. If that is rewarding, it takes us away from our pain, we're going to do it again and again and again. And that's the essence of addiction. That's it right there.
Your whole business, Brian, is based around change is possible. And I love that, because when I look at even pictures of myself before cancer and look at pictures of myself now, I'm a completely different person. And that's because I changed in mind, body and spirit and went on the journey. How did you, and I always ask people, you know, do you think you had a before and after in your life? And I don't even need to ask you that question. So how did you get from the before to the after? What was the moment?
So there was a very, very, very specific moment, and it happened. So as I said, I was working, I was in the depths of addiction, but it was like a noose around my neck, pulling tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter. And in the end, I lost my job. I lost all of the, like, my mom, my sister, my family. They had to pull away from me because to protect themselves, because I was destroying everyone around me. So I lost every relationship. I was 50,000 euros worth of in debt to money lenders, drug dealers. It was horrific.
And sorry, Brian, just before you go on there, where were you staying at this point?
So I was staying with my two brothers, and who were dealing with the angry me. Like, there was stages where, like, part of my groundhog day, like what I put my brothers through, part of my groundhog day would be coming home in my stupor. I'd have a bottle of vodka, but I'd pour a triple vodka into a glass. I'd fall asleep with the glass. If they took that off me, I'd be screaming at them. But if they didn't take it off me, I'd let it fall and smash on the ground, and then just make another vodka. Butts falling on the floor, burning the settees and all, and I was just angry, ball of anger. If anyone just bothered me in any way, it was really, really horrific. And it got to the stage, like, my two brothers are legends when I think about it. Like, I'm really close to my whole family today. We've great relationships today, we really do. But it got to the stage where I lost my job, and I says, right, I need to try another way, I need to do something else here. And I felt like I was dying. Like, I think I was close to death. I was physically, my body was physically giving up from all of the drugs I was taking, and I do believe I was close to death. And I remember saying, right, I'm gonna have to try to get clean. So I didn't know the ins and outs because I had that me machine gun of verbal diarrhea. If anyone came near me with recovery, I'd never even talked about it before. So I went to say, right, I'm going to have to try to get clean. What do I do? When I talked to my clinic, and they said to me, right, you take a lot of benzodiazepine as well as everything else. So you're going to have to get off them first because they won't take it into a detox facility, never mind a treatment facility, until you get off benzos. So I just thought I had to go into a center and get clean, but there's a lot of processes to that. So there was an 8-week waiting list to get into a detox, a benzo detox down the country. And I'm like, I'll be dead in 8 weeks. I can't wait 8 weeks. I'd be dead. I won't last 8 weeks. I'm going to be dead. And I genuinely believed there was this inner calling, that little bit of self, true self that was left in me says, you need to do this now. You need to do this now. And against the advice, and I would not advise anyone to do this because it nearly killed me. You can die doing this. But I decided to do a home detox myself on my own, coming off benzos. And I was taking probably 30 benzos a day, like crazy. Crazy amounts. Yeah, between Zopaclone, sleeping tablets and benzos, I was taking as many as I could pay for and get into my body at any stage. Like I had a crazy tolerance for sleeping tablets and benzos. And that'd kill a horse now, but when you build up that tolerance over time, it's crazy the amount of drugs you can take. Like taking 4 or 5 just wouldn't have made a dent in me. It was like drinking a glass of water. Crazy. It was mad. Wow. This is how messed up my biology was, because I'd wake up in the morning and I'd take about 5 or 6 sleeping tablets to get me going. So that's how crazy. Yeah, Zopaclone. Like I was taking sleeping tablets in the morning to give me a bit of a spark, to give me a bit of a, not a lift, just to make me feel a little bit okay. So the moment, the day, the night that came out, against advice of the clinic, they says, don't do this, but I done a detox at home on my own. And 2 days into that home detox was not only the most painful night in my life, it was the most important night in my life. I believe it was the defining moment, the transformational moment for me. And I woke up on my sitting room floor up in Tyrrellstown in Blanchardstown. My younger brother James was sort of minding me at the time through the detox. And I woke up on the floor and there was just blood all over the floor, blood all over my face. And what I had was a grand mal convulsive seizure. So basically every brain cell in my brain just fired at the same time. I convulsed on the ground, squeezing all my muscles, proper convulsive seizure. And I'd actually bitten my tongue. I drove my teeth through my tongue. So there was blood everywhere coming out of my mouth. And I was just in a ball on the ground. And my poor brother, James, he thought I was dead. He started crying, ringing me dad. I can't remember this. I just was told the story of what happened. Rushed to hospital. And I remember being in Blanchardstown Hospital after this experience. It felt like there was a balloon inside of me mouth. The pain in me body and the anxiety was just rippling through me. I just wanted to run away from myself. I never needed drugs more in my life than I need them right now. But I just know strength, Georgia. I was just broken in every single way, emotionally, mentally, and physically broken. And I remember just leaning up on the trolley. I was on a hospital trolley and I leaned up on the trolley. I mean, my elbow sort of just landed on my knees. And I remember just sort of me head just became fixated on this fire extinguisher that was hanging on the wall. And I remember trying to label it. I just said, what is that? And I couldn't name the fire extinguisher or the color of it or conceptually name anything. And I was like, what's going on? And I was looking around the room and I couldn't make sense of anything and I couldn't verbalize anything. And I said to myself, oh my God, that's brain damage. I'm brain damaged. I'm gone. Game over, Brian. You're done. And anxiety and panic chased me my entire life, as I says, Georgie. That's what I was always running away from. And I was waiting in that moment just to be completely overwhelmed. My worst fears coming true, death, brain damage, whatever it was. But I remember just saying to myself, I can't do this anymore. I am done. I'm out. I'm done. There's the white flag. I cannot fight this anymore. You win. And it was like this sense of peace came over me. It was like the first time in my life I stopped fighting reality. I stopped fighting my own mind. And it was like just this peace came over me. And I believe that was the moment. There was still lots of moments that had to happen within that time frame after that. But that was the moment when I really, it was like a chink in the armor of the start of me transforming my life and feeling like a completely different person.
And when you say there, like you gave up, you were just like, I can't do it anymore. Were you giving up on life or giving up on drugs at that moment?
giving up fighting my own mind, trying to resist. It was like, it wasn't life. I wasn't giving up on life. I was never suicidal. It was like, I can't beat you. I can't beat this. Whatever this is, I can't beat it. You win. There was a surrendering in that. And I was kind of giving up to the drugs. That's a great question. I've never been asked that question before. And it gets me really thinking there. It was like whatever I was fighting all of that time, the anxiety, the feelings, the battle I was in all of those years, it was like I've lost a battle. And it was only when I surrendered to the battle that I stopped trying to push against it, that yeah. a bit of peace came into my life. It was really weird.
Wow, because we know Claire Solon, she's always talking about surrendering, especially when she gets into the sea. She's always says, I surrender, I surrender. And it's like, you know, you're fighting against something. But if you surrender, just you can almost pass through.
Yeah, it's Claire. I love chatting. I chatted to Claire about this at the Good Glow Live. We were chatting about this very concept as well. And it's really interesting. I'm fascinated of late, especially by the paradox of life. And for me, it's about never giving up and always putting the actions in to bring the best part of yourself. But sometimes you have to let go. Sometimes you have to surrender. And it's nearly the ebbs and flows in life. There's at different times you have to let go and you have to surrender if your energy's a little bit low. And for me, at that point, it was just stopping that fight, and it was only by stopping that fight that I could rise up another day and take another step in a different direction. But I had to fall down first.
I hope you're enjoying my podcast with Brian, and I'm so excited to get into a little bit of coaching and how we can fly at 15,000 feet and give the best version of ourselves to the world. But first, I wanted to take the opportunity to thank ReproMed for supporting the Good Glow this season. A fertility journey is so personal, and ReproMed pride themselves in taking compassionate interest in your care. Having spent time with the team, I know they will provide you with everything you need to know about treatment options in a safe, supportive, and honest environment. ReproMed.ie is packed full of information on IVF, egg donation, fertility preservation, and so much more. Visit repromed.ie for more. What happened? Can you remember the days after that moment?
Vividly. So I basically, the month after that, it took me a month to get the benzos out of my system. I had another couple of seizures. I had another couple of hospital visits, and I was a shell of a human being. I was broken. I didn't even go to bed for a month. I slept on my couch for a whole month. I didn't even wash for the whole month. I probably didn't wash for 2 years before that, but that's another story.
Brian, I can't believe you were doing this on your couch. I fully thought you were going to say you were still in hospital.
No, they sent me home. It was like they just seeing me as another addict coming into the hospital. It was going to happen again, and sometimes they obviously based that on experience. So they just let me home the next day. They let me out the next day. They took loads of blood tests and stuff like that. I have very little memory of what went on. I just know from experience, from me dad was with me in the hospital. He drove me home the next day, and it's crazy.
That's scary. That's like you're just being kind of left to yourself again.
Yeah.
Go back then to the what happened in the days after.
Yeah, see, as well, they thought it was drug induced, so they didn't think it was me trying to get clean. They thought it was a drug induced seizure, so that was an element of it as well. So I spent the month, as I said, spent the month on the couch. Don't have many memories. I remember having to ring and make phone calls at that time to do with my old job, and it was a really important phone call, and I couldn't even hold the phone in my hand. I hadn't got the strength to grip the phone. So that's just how physically and mentally broken that I was at that stage. But I finally got the benzos out of my system, and I got into a detox facility with my methadone doctor, who prescribed me methadone for 12 years. He was the doctor in this facility. I've gone on to do research with him, Dr. Hugh Gallagher. He was really, really good to me. It was great.
Wow, that's amazing.
It was amazing. And I went into the facility, and I was still taking methadone. I had to be on a certain amount of methadone. So all of the drugs were out of my system except methadone, and I was going to do a methadone detox then in that facility. And when we were in there, I sort of got introduced to different concepts like mindfulness, self-awareness. The psychologist in there gave me a book about these kinds of things. It was called The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. And it's a great message in the book. Wouldn't be a book that I'd recommend to people, but it was my it was my first taste of these concepts. And I remember there was like a little whisper going through my head while I was in detox. Like, I still had a big challenge ahead of me getting off methadone for the first time in God knows how many years. But there was like a whisper in me mind that kept on saying to me, says, you might have a life again. You might have a life again. And as I was in that detox, it was a little farm up on the outskirts of Dublin, up in Knoll. But lovely little spot. I have a really great memories of the place, even though I was going through the depths of detox in there. But it was my first experience of these kinds of concepts, which really changed my life. And I remember just thinking, like, this is just amazing. This is just like, I could have this incredible life again. But the delusion that was in that as well, George, like, I'll give you a funny story. Like, at one stage, I was reading these books and I start saying to myself, am I like one of these sages in the books? Maybe I'm a sage. Maybe this is the start of my journey to be like the next Buddha. Like, there was this real delusional stuff going on at the same time of the logic as well. And I remember I remember thinking, like, I was about presence and being in touch with nature and the animals, and there was chickens on the farm and there was different animals on the farm. And I got this idea into my head that I was sort of really connected with the animals, right? So I remember at one stage, like, this is obviously a bit coming off the drugs as well, I walked up to the back of the farm near a stream and I was closing my eyes, being like super present at one stage. And I had this feeling that when I opened my eyes, all the animals would be gathered around me, like, and it'd be like this moment. I thought it was Dr. Doolittle, like, it was crazy. And I remember just opening my eyes, George. I opened my eyes and there was nothing. The stream was nothing. There was no animals around me. And I just started breaking my heart, laughing at myself, saying, what are you like? You're absolutely nuts, absolutely crazy. And there was loads of little crazy little moments like that of me reconnecting with the real world, because I was living in such a crazy place.
I was just about to say, that's the life coming back.
That's the life coming back. But the absolute moment, George, right, it was my first day clean, the 8th of October 2013, and I woke up. I was coming down like 60 mils of methadone, 55, 50 every few days. The day before this was my last 5 milliliters of methadone. It was my first day clean. Now, I was going through really difficult withdrawals at this stage, but there was these moments of lightness in it, these moments of pure euphoria where I was having this shift in awareness. It was really crazy. I'd stay up in the nighttime scribbling all stuff in my journal, thinking my life is just going to be amazing. Like, there was something really, there was an awakening of sorts happening within that. But I woke up that morning and I went down to the kitchen, and there was just something different about the day, something different, wonderfully different. And I remember walking out to the farm that morning and walking around the farm, and I'll never forget it. The grass was just like really lush, dewy grass, blue skies. It was going to be a gorgeous sunny day. You could see it happening. And it just felt like nature was actually breathing on my skin. The noise of the birds singing were just like so cheerful and so sharp and so crisp. Everything, the sensations and the perceptions of everything was just really just flowing into me. It's really, really hard to put into words. And I think some of the most important experiences are hard to put into words because we haven't got the words for them, because they're the feelings. But it was just this incredible feeling of presence that I had in that moment. And that was just like, I've never really gotten it back to that level before. It was sort of like a fleeting moment that I had, but it was just that shift in energy that's had a residue and has carried with me throughout that day. That was just an incredible experience.
Who was the happiest to see you transition into this new life?
So it was quite difficult at that time, Georgie. So I was the happiest for me. And there was a problem in that, because I was still very self-centered. It was all about, my whole addiction was Brian, Brian, Brian. Now that I was in recovery, it was about Brian, Brian, Brian. So I was having this really spiritual experience, but I was very disconnected from the real world. So while I was in detox, having this amazing spiritual experience, which I didn't really have words for at the time, I sent a letter to my sister and to other people that I cared for, telling them that I will fix them. I had this experience that I will fix them when I get out. So that was the level of actual, yeah, connection with that as well. So I was very disconnected from reality. And that's something that I don't often, it doesn't actually come up. So very disconnected, having this amazing experience, but disconnected from reality as well. And my family were really worried. Like when I got out with detox, I got brought down to a treatment center down in Wexford. And the shift in perspective I had, I knew I was never going to do drugs again. I knew that something had shifted in an incredible way in my mind, in my body, in my soul. But they didn't know that. And they just seen this sort of person that was high on life, still acting like he didn't care about anything else and everything was fine, but they didn't experience what I experienced. So they hadn't got that in that as well. So there was a lot of fear around me getting out as well. And it was only through time when they start seeing that I was living me truth, that my actions were matching what I was saying, that they really started to be delighted for me. And as I said, today now we just have these incredible relationships. Like when I used to make my mom cry, now I go up and I make her laugh. We go and I make sure I see my mom at least once a week, sometimes a couple of times a week, and we just have such a good laugh together and just great conversations, great connections. So it wasn't a quick process. There was no magic wand to fix those relationships. It was a long process. It really was.
Do you feel like in your recovery that you finally dealt with that anxiety or that childhood trauma and was able to move on from that?
Yeah, so there was a shift. There was a huge shift in perspective. When I had that shift, it was like anxiety was to an extent washed away. So something shifted within that. And my life goal and part of my PhD and the work I do has been exploring what the hell was going on there. So yeah. I remember when I went to the treatment center, I was doing a guided mindfulness exercise, and the guy was talking and he says, thoughts will go in and thoughts will come out. And I remember having this realization, wow, my mind is really quiet. It used to be always 100 miles an hour, compulsively thinking, afraid of the future. And I said to myself, what is the relationship between the quiet mind and the negative emotions that I felt, the anxiety that I felt? And that sort of a journey I went on, excuse me, when I did the degree in psychology, because I wanted to explore what this relationship was. And I went on, part of my PhD is looking at the relationship between self-talk, the thinking that we do, and the emotions that we experience and our beliefs and all of these things. And what I found was that language is a vehicle for emotion. Like one of my favorite quotes by Hafiz is, the words we speak become the house we live in. And it's like, as we've chatted about before, limiting beliefs. I'm not good enough. I'm never going to amount to anything. Or my story, I can't cope. And if you don't think you can cope with life, well, when life gets in the way, you're going to be anxious and fearful of not being able to cope, and you're going to use drugs. So when I had that shift in perspective, all of a sudden I had this belief that I can cope with this. I was developing strategies to be able to cope with these things, but my mind went very quiet. So I wasn't consistently telling myself that I'm not good enough, that I'm not man enough, that I can't cope, that I'm only an addict. So because I hadn't got that internal mindset, I wasn't feeling those negative emotions as well. And I believe that's what gave me the space to feel that to feel nature like I did in that moment. And I was just much more in the present moment. So there was a real mixture of all of those different things going on.
It's so inspiring. When you have spoken to me in the past, you've spoken about this, like flying at 15,000 feet. And I've used it nearly, I'd say, on every podcast since we have had that conversation. But tell us about, was the day in the hospital looking at the fire extinguisher the ground?
The ground. It wasn't the ground, Georgie. I was 200 feet under the rubble. Yeah, I was thinking about this to myself. Where was I? Like, did I crash and hit the ground? I was under the rubble. I crashed and I was buried under the ground. That's really where I was at that stage. And when I think about that, like flying at 10,000 feet, I think it really gives us agency. It empowers us to be able to lift ourselves higher, because it helps us to see, well, if I do this and I do that, I can actually reach higher up into the sky. So when life's bumps, when the bumps in the road come, it might knock me down, but I'm not going to crash into the ground. So definitely, I was on the ground. I was in the rubble. And that was the start of my journey of trying to fly higher and try to keep myself up in the air.
So when you're at 15,000 feet, and that's, say, a really great day, you're getting up, you feel in flow, you know, and then something might happen. Anxiety creeps in. You read something, you get an email, someone pisses you off. You're going down to 10,000 feet. Then something challenging, really bad happens. You're down at 2,000 feet. But are you saying that the tools, the meditation, the work, the exercise, whatever it may be, is going to help you cope better?
Yeah, that's the essence of it right there, Georgie. It's like exercise is critical. Nutrition, sleep, all critical. Gratitude, talking to friends, therapy, whatever it is to lift you higher. And there's so many tools for that. I have a magic wand. I believe it's my personal magic wand. Like all of the things I've talked about there, especially exercise, is absolutely critical. That will get you up 5,000 feet minimum. Like it really is the best tool in your toolbox. But and they're all preventative tools. Like so when the bumps in the road come, you're flying high enough so you don't hit the ground. So it's the work, it's like self-care capital that you put in before the challenges come along. So you're not going to have to be firefighting and coping with stressful situations. You're going to be able to manage the stressful situations. But the tool that I do have that is the most important tool in my locker, and it came from my experiences as well, and it's really self-observation, but there's a way that I sort of talk about it that makes it more palatable to people as well. So it's and it's from Buddhist philosophy as well. So it's like we experience in life, there's first darts and second darts. The first darts are the darts that life throws at us. And if you live in love, you are going to experience first darts. The war over in the Ukraine, COVID-19, lockdown, getting COVID, other people being mean to you, other people saying something about you on social media, whatever that is, political situations. All of these things are things that are outside of our control. And this is the essence of human existence. People will get hurt that you love. People will die potentially at some stage. This is the human experience. These are the first darts. But this is not why we suffer. We suffer because of the second darts. And these are the darts that we throw at ourselves. Anger, anxiety, jealousy, guilt. And they're our reactions to challenging situations. But between the first dart and your second dart, a potential second dart of where all the problems start, there's a space. And Viktor Frankl talks about this a lot, the space between the stimulus and response. And if you can increase that space and sit with yourself, sit with the emotions, the triggering that happens from the first darts, take a pause and sit with that, you will not create those second darts, and you won't be getting angry, jealous, resentful, whatever those things are. And that is the essence of being happier. And when they're the things that bring you down, like it's not so much the bumps in the road that bring you down, it's your reaction to the bumps that bring you down, that trigger other bumps in the road, that you might have an argument with someone else and you might be guilty because you got angry, and then you're depressed because you got guilty because you got angry over some simple little row that just escalated out of all proportions. And that really for me is the magic wand, to be keeping an eye on your inner world, watch yourself, and it's really crucial. So I have a nice story, George, as well, that really taps into this idea. And it was really my biggest learning of how powerful this can be. So part of my story was, as a child, is that I got deported from Canada as a 5-year-old. We won't go into the depths of that. Obviously my parents were deported. I wasn't deported. I always remember the police on the airplane when we came back. I remember feeling it was my birthday and I felt very special because the police were on the plane with us, which is an interesting memory. But when I was in 2018, I think it was, I was back going over to Canada again for a big academic retreat or an academic conference, and I was going to be speaking for the first time at a big academic conference. Super excited. Trinity College gave me money to go over to this conference. I saved up money for myself as well. It was over in Montreal, cost a few quid, and there was a lot of work put into this conference. And the morning I was due to fly over with my professor, he was going to be following me over. I went to get on the plane, and I'd never filled out an ETA, it's called, to get into Canada. Didn't even know about it. But the guy said, it's fine, just fill it out there. You'll be able to get on the plane. Usually takes 10 minutes to approve. So I was thinking at the time, God, I hope they don't hold it against a 5-year-old getting deported, but I didn't think they would. So I filled out the ETA and it came back that I didn't get through. So the guy says, sorry, you can't get on the plane. And I was like, what do you mean I can't get on the plane? He says, that's ridiculous. He says, look, it's not approved. We can't let you on the plane. And I remember about to get really angry at the guy. And I says, look, nothing he can do about it. He says, what's the best solution for this? What can I do? And he says, look, call this number and see what they say. Send them an email, see what they say. It was the Canadian authorities. So I'd missed my plane at this stage. And I went home, sent an email to them. I still had time to get to the conference to get another flight. So I sent the Canadian authorities an email. And I woke up the next morning and I had two emails. One saying that I could get into Canada, my ETA was approved. And the other one saying, I'm an illegal immigrant, you'll never get into Canada. So I says, right, which one am I going to believe? So I says, I'm going to go with this, my ETA approval. I got another flight, a loan of €1,200 off my mum and dad, flew over to Canada, got a new ticket, flew over to Canada. When I arrived in Montreal, I got off the plane and I was walking through and they had actually Canadian authorities. This woman came over to me and she says, look, we have to bring you into a room. I have to have a chat with you. There's a bit of a problem with you coming into the country. So when we were walking to the room, I was saying to the woman, I says, is it to do with my ETA? She says, oh, you know about that. And I says, look, I was deported as a 5-year-old. Didn't think he'd hold that against me. I was having a bit of a laugh with her. And we got into the room and she says, look, I'm really sorry, but we're going to have to send you back to Ireland. And I was sitting there saying, right, I was annoyed. I could feel it in my body. I was like, oh my God. But I says, right, think of the space, focus on the space, focus inwardly. There's nothing you can do about the situation. And I was nearly smiling at my ability to catch that in full flight. So she actually asked me, she says, can I ask you why you're pretty happy about this? You don't seem too bothered by this at all. And I says, look, I was in addiction for years. I'm over here to do a talk on mindfulness. It's an academic conference. Says I wouldn't really be walking my talk if I was sitting here giving out about everything. So what can I do? It's out of my control. We'll just run with it. So we had another chat for a few minutes and she just looks at me and she says, you know what, Brian, I'm going to let you in. Don't tell anyone. And she stamped me ticket into the country. And it was one of the biggest learnings, Georgie, for me. It was like there was a space between the trigger and my response, like anger, giving out what I should have done or what most people would have done in that situation. But that space allowed me to get into Canada and give that talk. It was just a really special moment for me. And just to see that working in action was just great, you know?
Oh my God, that's so inspiring. So what that space was, the tools that you have that were able to control your reaction, was it?
Yeah, and really, like, it's about to increase that space. Like, I do believe exercise is one of the things. Like, if you're less aroused all of the time, like, you're less triggered by things, you are going to be just less stressed about different things. But the big thing for me is I tried to practice self-awareness or self-observation. So it's like having one eye. Like, when that guy in the airport told me you can't get on the plane, I wanted to jump. I wanted to say, what do you mean I can't get on the plane? That's ridiculous. But I just caught myself. I had one eye on the inside, watching myself, watching my emotions, watching my feelings, watching me thinking, watching my bodily sensations. And I just think, right, keep an eye on that. There's no point on acting with that. So it's taking a pause when the monkey mind wants to react. The monkey mind wants to scream. The monkey mind wants to fight. So it's catching that and stopping that, taking a pause, creating a bigger space between the stimulus and your response to that, the first dart and the second dart. And I truly believe that's where, like, a life of freedom really lives.
Just when you were saying there, like, that, you know, exercise brings you up 5,000 feet, right? So in this house, so myself and Jamie, like, we're married, you know, we spend every waking minute together, we work together, we've been at our kitchen table for 2 years. And I recently went back to counseling and I'm trying to kind of, it doesn't sound pathetic. This is my truth, right? So I am really attached to Jamie. I'm really attached to the house. I find it really hard to put myself out there again after COVID. And I'm sure lots of people can relate to that. So when I went to counseling, I said, like, it really annoys me that Jamie's not a morning person, because I love the morning. I get up every day. Same. I'm in such a good mood. Pia is a morning person. And if I have an interaction with Jamie, like before 8 o'clock in the morning, he probably doesn't bring me down. I probably bring myself down, but I'm dropping 2,000 feet because I'm not getting the reaction from him that I want. Okay. So I said to my counselor, you know, I love mornings. Like, should I just go for a walk in the morning? Because that's what I really want to do. And she was like, Yes. So now when I wake up in the morning, I'm like, how can I get up to 15,000 feet? Because if I stay in the house with Jamie, I might get to 7,000 feet because he's not feeling my vibe. So I go out for a walk, or I get Piper into the car, bring Pia to school, and I'm gone. I'm out into nature and I come back ready for the day. Then Jamie hits his 15,000 feet at like 10 o'clock at night. So I'll be in bed, like trying to chill out. I'll have like my happy pod on with my essential oils and I'm trying to meditate, and Jamie will come in and start speaking to me about work, and I'm like, get out. So then I bring him down, you know, yeah, because we're just out of flow a little bit. But I love the theory of being responsible in how you can get yourself higher and not kind of blaming maybe other people for dragging you down.
That, I love that. And that word responsible, I remember hearing something about that word that just blew me away, right? So responsible comes from the words response able. Two words, response able. Are you able to respond for other people? No, you can only respond for yourself. You're only responsible for yourself. So when you have those expectations of other people and you want them to respond the way you want them to respond, which is impossible, those expectations aren't reached, that you're going to be unhappy. Like, that's nearly the essence of unhappiness, is when your expectations aren't met. So it's really important just to focus on what you can do. What are you responsible for? Your response to the situation. And again, that limits those second darts. Like, you're not getting, you might get triggered by something, so you're saying, that's the fourth dart, I'm not getting the response that I want, my expectations aren't being met, but am I going to get down, am I going to get agitated? No, I'm actually going to go out and I'm going to lift myself higher. I'm going to do something for me because that is within my control. I'm going to lift me, and then you're both lifting each other if you with that kind of a mindset, you know.
Wow, that, yeah. Have you forgiven yourself, Brian, for everything?
It's really weird. And I've talked about this, like, I say this to people, I don't regret my addiction. I lost 15 years of my life. You could really say that I lost 15 years of my life. And I'm not resentful, and I don't regret missing those years, because I think it was part of the process, part of the journey for me to become who I am today. And I love what I have today and who I am today. And we only ever have the present moment. That's the reality of it. But there is regrets in how I treated people. Now, I used to justify and rationalize it and says, well, I didn't go beating people up, I didn't mug grannies, or I didn't do that stereotypical thing that addicts do, I didn't rob me mom. Now, I did cause other harms, there was other harms in there as well, but I never actively sought out to do those things. But I scarred my family in other ways, this relentless just gnawing at them, seeing me destroying myself. And I wish that I didn't do that to them. I wish I sort of removed myself from the situation, because I nearly feel that, especially my mom and my sister, that they're more hurt for my addiction than I am, because I had this huge lift of life. I was lifted up to 15,000 feet, whatever the hell happened to me in that shift in perspective, but they were still left living in the real world. Now, over time, I've come back down a little bit. I'm back in the real world again, and we've reconnected on that as well. And I regret what I did, but there's nothing I can do about it. And all I can do now is to be in the present moment and give myself as much as I can right now in the moment. And that does alleviate some of the pain that I feel around it.
Yeah. I think it's really important to, like, even though you've been through the most horrible time, to acknowledge that without that pain, you wouldn't be where you are today. And, you know, even without my cancer, which I hated so much for so long, I wouldn't be here. So, you know, it's easy, I suppose, to look back and say, I'm grateful for the experience, but jeepers, it's hell on earth going through it. Yeah. Tell me about your proudest moment. And obviously, you've gone on to achieve so much, and you're Dr. Brian Penny now. That's just so inspiring and incredible. Is there a standout moment over the last few years for you?
Wow, standout moment. The standout moment over the last few years, it's definitely to do with other people. There's something I do. There's something I love in my life. It's like helping people to turn on those little light bulb moments. And I love that on a consistent basis. But I was very disconnected with myself. And even 5 years into recovery, I was still a little bit disconnected. And it was only when I wrote my book that I realized the pain that it caused me family that I started getting more connected with myself. And just before COVID, I met my current partner, Natalie. And it was right before COVID, like, so we didn't even meet each other for a while. We got in contact on social media and through a post on Instagram, and we started texting back and forth just about a brain, the study that I done with my brain. And then we just got chatting and we really got on great, and we started having these video calls, like ridiculous video calls. It was obviously going places. We're together now. We have a great relationship now today. But we had at one stage, we had an 8-hour video call. Like, who has 8-hour video calls? It was absolutely mental. But I had never, when I heard people talking about feelings of love and the warming of their heart, I thought it was just metaphorical. I didn't think it was actually real. And even though I'd never met Natalie at this stage, we were spending all day on video calls to each other. We were waiting for this was the heart of COVID, so we couldn't travel more than 5 kilometers, so we couldn't meet. So we were just spending all of our time together. And I remember I was lying in bed one night, and I sort of felt this sort of pulling sensation around my chest. And I said, what's that? That's really weird. And I felt nice. And it was like this pulling in my chest. I said, what the hell is that? And it was only in retrospect the next day. I think that was the first time I'd actually felt like proper, full romantic love ever in my life. I was so closed off in my emotions. So that is definitely the standout moment in terms of my recovery, in terms of experiential stuff. It was just like, and it's just been a wonderful 2 years, to be quite honest. So that's definitely the one that jumps out.
Wow, Brian, that is the perfect answer. You know, that is, for me, just, I thought you were going to say when you became Dr. Brian Penny, no. But that falling in love, wow. I think I'm falling in love with you right now after you said that. So your whole business is based around change as possible. And I'll leave it with this question. So what you're saying to, do you say to anybody at all, that change is possible?
Change is possible no matter what. And it's like, change is hard. That's the reality of it. Change is really, really hard. But the reality is, it's possible for everybody. But sometimes it's only about these baby steps. Like, we need to, like, we talk about self-belief a lot, Georgie. Like, for self-belief, to change your belief that you can actually change and do something, you need to build a wall of evidence. And to build a wall of evidence, it's around taking those baby steps. When I first got into college, I didn't believe I could write. That was my biggest problem. I couldn't even write emails. So I started saying, well, I'll do a little writing course. And I get a little bit there, a little bit there. I've done these really basic things. I wrote a book on how to write. I learned about grammar from the bottom up. And now it's one of my greatest passions. I wrote a book on the back of that. So it's baby steps. Everyone can change, but you've got to develop that growth mindset. That is really, really critical. And it's even with What I'm noticing now myself as well, it's pulling back. Like, I'm crazy about all these tools and tactics for life, which are really, really important. But a lot of the work that I'm doing with clients, and I do a lot of work in the corporate environment now as well. And it's like a program that I've developed, like, for my own life. It's like about self-awareness and the values that sit on top of that. And then all of the tools and tactics. And it's like certain modules I have in the program, and I've been bringing people along on the journey. But something happened recently where I was bringing people through on this program, and what we noticed was there was just this incredible connection and sense of community within the groups. And what I realized was, it was nothing to do with the tools, which the tools are really, really good and are really, really important, but it was the basic questions that we were talking to people about, like, what lights the fire in your belly, what is your superpower, what is your kryptonite. And when we were sharing these things in different groups and truly connecting with each other, miracles were happening. It really was this beautiful connection that was happening in the group, creating these different communities. So I think change, for me, change is possible for everyone. But when you do it with other people, and you do it in groups, and you keep yourself self-accountable with other people, get yourself an accountability partner, keep yourself accountable, try to do it with someone else, because I think change with other people happens a lot more easier. But it's definitely, long answer, but it's definitely possible for anybody. It really is.
Yeah, I believe that too. I really believe in the baby steps, because I think change is overwhelming. But if you just do one thing differently the next, like tomorrow, yes, you never know where that could bring you.
Yeah, it's focusing on the process, the next step, the next step, the next step. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I love being in your company. I know everybody does. You are an absolute ray of sunshine, and just the energy you bring to the world is such a gift to us all, Brian. And I'm so glad that I can call you a friend. Thank you for everything that you've done for me.
Same, Georgie. It's such a privilege getting to know you and to come on the podcast. I was dying to have this conversation, and I loved every second of it. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of the Good Glow podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly did. And it was interesting. I spoke to Brian briefly just after our chat about what to do when we feel that urge of picking up our phone. And Brian said instead what he does is he takes 5 deep breaths. So instead of checking his phone, 5 deep breaths. And he also, this is hardcore, he puts his phone away at 6 p.m. every evening. So I might give that a go this week. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please leave a review if you enjoyed this episode. Those reviews and subscribes really help. So thank you so much in advance for that. And if you'd like to join us at the National Concert Hall for our next show on May 30th, head over to nch.ie for tickets. I'll see you next week.